Thank you very much. After all that great applause, I can hardly wait to hear what I've got to say. I want to express my appreciation and gratitude for all of you for participating in this meeting tonight, and for you have been so doggone nice ever since we got here. We had a couple of cute gals that Christie and Paula met me at the airport, and they haven't let me go to the bathroom since. But that's all right, I'll tell you that. My name is Cersei, and I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God and the help of all of you, Al-Anons, Alateens, Alatots, Alators, and all in between, I have not found it necessary to take a drink since May 10th, 1946. And for that, I'm deeply grateful. I'll tell you one thing, I have some important numbers in my life that I want to share with you. And those numbers are 91, 67, 55. I'm 91 years old. I've been married to the same woman for 67 years, and I've been sober 55 years. How's that combination? That's only by the grace of God and because you helped me achieve and keep sobriety. And you showed me the way to be happy, joyous, and free. Now, I'll tell you one thing. If we're not having fun out here tonight, as cold as it is, there's something wrong. Yeah. They invited me to Savannah, and I wound up in the ocean. But the great people, and you have a wonderful group of Alcoholics Anonymous here and all over this area. My story, and I hope I don't get into drunkalog. You know, our drunkalogs are sacred to us because that's what happened to it. But to listen to it, we had a guy the other night that did 55 minutes of drunkalog and 5 minutes about AA. And for me, I like to hear what the solutions are to a drinking problem. And I hope, along with my story of what actually happened to me, that we'll hear something about what's the solution to my drinking problem. How can I not drink? And that's our purpose for being here, not because of convention or not this and that, or because Oyster or this. We're here because we're powerless over alcohol and our lives are unmanageable. And that's the bottom line. No matter what else we do, and there are a lot of things we do that help us to stay sober and be happy, joyous, and free. But the bottom line is exactly what Abby told Bill that time. And he said, what is this religion you got? He said, well, it's not religious spirituality. Well, what do you do? And this is before AA. This is in the Oxford group. He said, we trust God, clean house, and help others. And all of our literature and everything that's said and done about Alcoholics Anonymous through the years and even right now, the bottom line still is trust God, clean house, and help somebody else. And we can't change that. If we ever change it, then we're in bad shape. But I will tell you a little bit about the bad things that happened to me, and all of the bad things, and I've had a lot of bad things happen to me over the years in my life, and I've had a lot of good things happen. But it took every one of those for my recovery. All of the bad things that happened, I hope I never forget them. And if I ever forget my last drink, I may not have had it, because I remember it pretty damn well. I remember exactly where I was and how it happened and why I had to have the last drink. I was born out in West Texas, way out in the dry, sorry country out there, and I was raised on a farm. And it was a sorry farm at that, but I never saw a good one. My mother used to tell me, she said, I was more of a planter than I was a farmer. I planted it and hoped the hell it didn't grow, you know. That's kind of a farmer I was. There were seven of we kids in the family, and we were poor people financially. But we were rich in some of the most important things in the lives of all of us, and that is a way to live with the help of God. It was the help of a higher power. My father and mother were devout Baptists, and I'm a recovering Baptist too. Don't hold that against me. We raised on a farm, here's the thing. Some of these things that happened in my youth, in my early years in life, were so, and I never knew the importance of those things until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. They had no meaning, really, until I came into AA, and these things that happened way back, and all those things that happened along are a part of my recovery, and if they hadn't happened, I wouldn't be sober. They had to happen. That's part of it. And I'm grateful for it. All the bad things and all the good things. Luckily, on that farm, I finally had, by the grace of God, I had an old aunt up in Stamford, Texas. Now, I was raised at Funston, Texas, and I don't see any pep squad here from Funston either. It's way the hell out in the boondocks, and nobody'd want to live out there, and very few do. So, I had an old aunt in Stamford, Texas. I'm getting up to the big cities now. It's probably about 1,400 or 1,500 people. And I had an old aunt up there that had a boarding house, and she asked me to come live with her and finish high school, go to high school. And I accepted it very, very gratefully, I'll tell you that. And I stayed with her and finished high school in Stamford, Texas in 1928. And the day I finished high school, I had a contract to play semi-pro baseball in the old West Texas League out in Midland, Texas, out in West Texas, way out there. And I went out to Midland, and they gave, in those days, they didn't pay, in AAA baseball, they didn't pay you a salary. They'd get you a job. And you work with some kind of a job, and then you play baseball on a weekend. And that's what I did. I went to work for a big motor company out there, and I had to do that for 4 or 5 days during the week, and then play 2 or 3 baseball games on the weekend. And I was grateful that I was off that farm, and grateful for all those things that happened. Anything, if I get away from that farm, I was grateful for it. But anyhow, in our baseball, you know, I don't know about you, but I never did like to drink with a sorry drinker. Somebody, my wife is one of them. And she'll order one of those grasshoppers, whatever that is, and there's salt all around the top of it. And we'll sit and eat a meal, and the damn salt is still on it when we get through. And the whatever's in it is still there. That's just a waste of money. You know. I like to drink it up and drink a bunch of it, puke it up and drink some more, and just keep on drinking until you get... That's the way to drink. That's a good drinker. A sorry drinker is... Well, anyhow, on our we had our baseball manager was named Doc Ellis, and Doc had a funeral parlor, and that's a hell of a combination, isn't it? A funeral parlor director and a baseball manager, but anyhow, he did. And after our games on Sunday afternoon, we'd all meet at the funeral parlor and celebrate our mostly having lost, I'm sure. But we'd celebrate with drinking home brew. Now, home brew is something you probably never had any of it. Thank God you didn't. It is made out of some kind of macaroni and cheese or something. It's fermented. It'd make you drunk. It's about 15 or 20% or more alcohol. But anyhow, we'd meet at the funeral home Sunday nights and drink beer and act silly, like most alcoholics do in that period of time. Well, we had a guy at our third baseman, and his name was Red Hill. And Red was a sorry drinker. He'd drink a beer or two and pass out, and no way to handle booze at all. Well, this one Sunday night, we were drinking beer and celebrating, and old Red had a couple of beers and passed out on the funeral floor. And we who could handle it so well were very indignant about the guy that couldn't handle beer any better than that, you know. So, in a little while, we picked him up and put him in a casket to get even with him. And we folded his arms and put a few roses around, stuck on his ears and this and that and the other, dressed him up. And we stood back to see what his reaction would be on that. And we stood back and waited a while, and finally Red aroused a little, and he started feeding of himself back in the side of the casket and all around. Then we heard him say, "Well, if I'm not dead, why am I here? And if I am dead, why do I have to go to the bathroom?" I think Red came into our fellowship later on. No, too. He qualified for our fellowship. Well, I was not born an alcoholic. No way. My father or brother never took a drink of alcohol in their lives. Never. None of my relatives that I know of had any history of excessive drinking. And my dad was a deacon in the Baptist church, and he wouldn't even let me say the word booze or liquor. I couldn't even say that. But anyhow, we can be born with that X factor in our lives, and we don't know what that is. But if you have that X factor in there and you keep drinking alcohol over long, if you have that X factor, you may cross that line into compulsive pathological drinking. And that's the only kind of drinking that's a disease. But when you have to drink to get away from the effects of drinking, that's pretty sick, isn't it? And that's what I had to do. So the road to drunkenness and the road to hell is built on that kind of highway, and I built it. I went right along with all those things that come with. And becoming an alcoholic, I increased my dosage of alcohol extremely from one time to another, and I kept on increasing that, and it always got worse. And the trouble about that is it's confusing. We start out drinking, handling, having a good time, handling things pretty well, and as we go along, these things start to happen, and they're cunning, baffling, and complete in terror. And if we follow that route and we are designed to be an alcoholic, then these things bad start happening. And so, along with my baseball career, I had to let that go, and then they made me general manager of this large corporation, and I had a real good job, made a lot of money, and I drank a lot of whiskey, and I got a lot of people drunk. Now, you know, you have to drink with customers to get business. You know that, don't you? And I entertained the hell out of them. I'll tell you, I carried a load of whiskey around and entertained day and night. And then you developed into that compulsive pathological pattern of drinking. And it's cunning, baffling, and bewildering. You don't know what's happened. But it keeps happening. It keeps happening because you can't stop drinking. And so I started working for a lot of narrow-minded employers. I don't know if you ever had that trouble or not, but they're very narrow-minded. You'd be out there gone a week or so or with one of their cars or whatever, and you come back, they won't know where you've been. It's really none of their business, you know. They're just paying you. So, anyhow, along with that development of alcoholism comes from truisms that always happens if you have that X factor in your life. So, I started taking the geographical cure. That is unlawful flight to avoid prosecution, if you don't know what that is. So I took that geographical cure, and the trouble with that is wherever you go, and however far it is, wherever it may be, the trouble is when you get there, there you are. That's the trouble. So you have to deal with that same guy, that same person, over and over and over. And it's bewildering, it's frustrating, and it's desperate in what you do a lot of times. And so they hired me to go to Corpus Christi, Texas, as credit manager of the Packard Corporation, Packard Automobiles. I don't know if you ever saw one. I may have been a Packard man back there, white-headed guy. But, probably a homebrew guy, too. But I would get in that Packard and go out on the King Ranch with a carload of booze and stay out there for 4 or 5 days just drinking. But I was on a strict diet, cheese and crackers, and a very strict diet, you know. But then I'd come in to back into to our place of business, and they wanted to know where you've been, you know. None of their business, you know, actually. And you're handling your affairs real well. So, well, my wife was a court reporter and a legal stenographer. And we lived in Big Spring, Texas, out close to where Midland is, where I played baseball, and we'd moved there long year before. And for several years, she made the living for us to get by when I was doing a lot of my drinking there, and made it possible for us to survive. So after I moved to Corpus Christi, I finally calling her several times and trying to convince her that if she would join me down there, I was going to slow down on my drinking. I was going to do better and not do all these bad things that I had done. And I finally persuaded her to come join me. Well, I finally got so lowly in my job. I didn't want anybody to see me in the condition I was in, having been a big CEO with a big corporation, you know, and a big shot and dot the I. So I started hiring out to just anybody that hired me, doing anything that I could, but I didn't want anybody to see me doing those things that degraded my position. So I hired out to this guy that had pickle trucks. They serviced hamburger joints, and they sold pickles and onions in gallon jars. And if you don't think that's a job, you try drunk to go out and handle a gallon jug and stay straight. Just try it. That's right. It's a job. Anyhow, on a day, I remember I picked up another drunk to go with me, and I was driving his pickle truck. And we got to a hamburger joint, and when we drove in, the guy said, "This is a holiday, don't you know it?" And I said, "No, but I'm damn glad of it." And so, without further ado, we took off and went to Mexico. And while there, I made some very important decisions about business. I traded that load of pickles and onions for booze. Just even. I didn't pay any difference or didn't get any difference. We just traded even. We got in the truck, went back to Corpus Christi, and checked in the New Aces Hotel. And neither of us had any money, but we checked in the presidential suite. You know, nothing too good for us. And we drilled oil wells, we changed millions of dollars and all that stuff, and didn't have a quarter, none of it, neither one of us. But anyhow, here's where your luck catches up with you. My wife could have worked for 400 lawyers in Corpus Christi. She worked for the one that represented the guy that I ran off of the truck. Now, you think your luck doesn't change, well, just try it. Just keep drinking. It'll change. So, my brother in Dallas decided that I needed another geographical cure. And so I moved to Dallas. He moved me to Dallas. And I went to work for Southern Aircraft. They built Grumman bomb doors for airplanes in World War II. Now, this is not the Revolutionary War. They put me in charge of time study. I studied the time of all those who worked out there. And you know, we alcoholics can pick out phonies. Did you ever notice that? We know phonies. I don't know why that is. But I observed in my observation there that there were a lot of people out there that were phonies, and that they were not doing their work, and that we were going to lose the war if we didn't get rid of them. And so they decided to get rid of me. So I went in the service of our country, and they sent me to Cheyenne, Wyoming. Now, I was 33 years old. I'd been drunk 20 years. So you know what kind of shape I was in physically. Pretty rough. Well, that was a mistake. And I did the best I could for about 11 months, but almost died with basic training and all that. But after 11 months, they decided if they're going to win the war, they better get rid of me. That's what they did. And I came back to Dallas. The day I got back to Dallas, the company that I used to do business with wanted me to go move to Lubbock, Texas, way out in West Texas, and work with distributors in the electric Autolite company. And we had automobile distributors. And they wanted me to work with the distributor people. So I had a real problem with drinking then. It had really grown terribly bad. And on a day, I was traveling with this salesman. We were in Odessa, Texas. That's another place out there. And his car broke down, and I said, "You get the car fixed. And I'm going to walk back to the hotel where we're staying." And we alkies are sharp, pretty sharp. I knew there's a liquor store between there and the hotel. So I stopped by and got me a pint of whiskey. And went on to the hotel. And in front of the hotel, I ran into an old drinking buddy of mine named Bob Skimmerhorn. Bob and his mother owned a big oil company in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and they were very rich people. And he and I did a lot of drinking together. He was a sorry drinker. He couldn't drink worth a damn, but he'd drink and pass out, and I'd steal his money. And I stayed drunk several years on his money. I knew he had a problem. I knew he had a drinking problem. And so I asked Bob, I said, Bob, I'm about to die. I'm glad to see you and all this. He had moved to Dallas. But I need a drink. And I've got some here. Let's go take a drink. And we went up the room and I poured out a couple of bottles, glasses of whiskey and pushed his over. And he said, you go on and take your, you need a drink, but I'm not drinking today. And after two or three drinks that I had, well, I asked him about what kind of venereal disease he had. He wasn't drinking, you know. And then he told me, he said, you have you another drink, and I'll tell you what happened. He said, I would get up at night and with a carload of liquor and drive around, and in front of DFW Airport, where it is now, he said, I ran into a carload of ladies, and three of them were killed. You can imagine the anguish and the problem that I have had, my mother and I having known and to know that she ran over somebody and killed them drunk. It's a terrible feeling, and it's unbearable almost to the human to kill three people drunk. And he said, I had to do something about my drinking, so I got affiliated with some guys there in Dallas. There are 10 of us. And it's called Alcoholics Anonymous, and we don't drink anymore. And he said, I've been sober 10 months, and then I knew he was lying. <You know. coughs> But we visited a while, and then he told me, he said, I'm going to send you the big book, what we call the big book, and I want you to read it, and then I want you to do what it says. And I said, send that book to the hotel where I'll be at. Don't send it to my wife. She'll think I've got a drinking problem, you know. And so he sent it to the hotel in Amarillo, Texas. And I took that big book and thumbed through it, I bet, 50 times. I never did read it, but can you imagine I kept drinking? If you just thumb through that big book, you may keep drinking. It doesn't work too good, you know, just thumbing through it. There's a little more to it than that. But I did that just to make my wife think. And then I carried that book home, so I thought I hid it from her. And she found the book and read it. She says now that she thought it was a real good thing, but she never had any idea that I would accept or do anything about my drinking. So, Bob, this guy, told me, he said, when you go, and you're about there now, when you go as far as you can go with your drinking problem, and said, you're there, almost there now, if not already, and you have been for a long time. But if you want to do something about your drinking and you've gone as far as you can go, you come to see me and I'll try to help you. You need some help to quit drinking. And so this was in August of 1945, and I lost that job in November of 45, and I stayed drunk every day, every night from November 45 till April 46. And then that sunlight of the Spirit that shined in, that interception of God, the higher power, or something happens, and we come to the realization that there's something wrong, and it's within me. So I remember what Bob told me, and I got on the plane, went to Dallas, and to find Bob. And after a couple of days, I located him. But by then, two or three other drunks and I that I used to work with there, we were holed up down in the hotel and stayed drunk. And they put me in an ambulance and took me out to a little drying out joint out close to where a little group that I go to now. And it was a 5-day deal. We stayed there, and they would give you an ounce of whiskey every 4 hours to keep you from having DTs. But hell, I'd been drinking a pint every 4 hours, so you can imagine how much good that would do. And so anyhow, Bob, after a couple of days, he called me and he said, I'm going to take you to an AA meeting, to a group. And I said, okay, I'll do whatever you say, Bob. And so they came, picked me up, and took me. We went downtown Dallas 912 and a half Main Street and parked in front of a liquor store. And then I knew AA had worked. And, but we didn't go in the liquor store. We climbed some stairs. And we went up, I must have been 50 steps. And here were 10 guys in there, happy, joyous, and free, sober, and joking and trying to help each other, and they were having fun. And I couldn't believe they were alcoholics. I couldn't believe they were like me. But here, by the grace of God, let me show you. Now let's remember this. Every single one of you people here tonight, I don't care what your position is in life, every single one of you are the only one that can help somebody out there that's looking for a way out right now. And I can't do it, he can't do it, she can't do it, but you can. Every one of us are responsible to stay sober to help somebody else. From the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous, Dr. Bob and Bill met. And you know what they talked about? Let's provide some way that a drunk can stay sober and help somebody else. And that's right from the beginning. That's the way it is. We stay sober, and the bottom line is, if we don't help somebody else, we don't stay sober. We have to come to the realization that we have to give away, the more we give away, the more we have left. And so, an example of that, when I first went to, in that group, there was a guy named Burl McInerney. He was a paving contractor. And out of the 10 guys there, he was the only one that could have made a difference in my life. He called me over to the board, and there was a 12 step. There were no traditions then. He called me and said, this is a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a program that if you will experience those steps, you'll never have to take another drink. Then he asked me some questions. He said, do you believe in God? I said, yes, I believe in God. Do you admit your powerless over alcohol, your life's unmanageable? I have no problem with that whatsoever. Well, he said, I want you to, every morning before you get out of bed, and I don't want any of your promises or propositions or New Year's resolutions and all that crap. I want you to commit to God that you'll not take a drink just today. And he said, can you go 24 hours without a drink? I said, I can do that. I can't go a week or a month, but I can go a day. But he said, I want you to do that every morning before you do anything. You make that commitment. Commit to God. And so, that is a slick way of doing it. He said, if you don't drink today, you never will drink. So tomorrow I got here and I couldn't drink. So I've been dumb enough to follow his pattern ever since then. He said, if you don't drink today, you never will. And I ain't going to drink today. I'm not going to drink today. I don't care what happens. My ass falls off, I'm not drinking today. No much. So, I lived in Lubbock, Texas, and there was not a group of Alcoholics Anonymous between Fort Worth and Phoenix, Arizona, 1,200 miles. Not a group. So, it was lonely. And we talk about talking to big crowds and big this and that. This. Don't you know that Dr. Bob and Bill, those early days, just the two of them meeting to find out a way to help us, don't you know it was lonely? We probably wouldn't go. If we kept going the way of just two of us in a meeting, we'd get tired of each other. And we quit going. But imagine that, don't you know the heartfelt interest they had in us, that let's keep going, let's stay sober, let's provide a way that an alcoholic can stay sober and help somebody else. And they were talking about us all the time and all these plans and everything that went on. It was about you and I, that we someday we can have a way to get well and not have to drink anymore. So anyhow, once a month, I'd lost my card, lost everything, and once a month I'd get on the bus and go to Dallas to a meeting. Whether I needed the meeting or not, I'd just go anyhow once a month. And they helped to talk with somebody, and they knew what they're talking about, right? But without a group and without somebody to talk to on a daily basis, I could have never stayed sober in my life, no way, without being around AA's, if I had not had a commitment to God not to drink. There has to be a solution. I couldn't imagine life without drinking. What the hell would you do if you didn't drink? And the only way I found out was that the method that he gave me, the solution that he gave me. And if he hadn't given me a solution, then you think I could have gone out there 350 miles from an AA group, not one, and stayed sober? No, I couldn't have made it. So I had a way, until I could experience those steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had to have a way not to drink so that I could stay sober and stay sober myself by helping somebody else. And when I got in that position. So, all at once, all over that country, AA mushroomed. It grew very, very fast, and it brought along a lot of problems too. In 1946, in September, we had the state convention of AA in Austin, Texas, the capital. And Bill and Lois Wilson came down for that and talked. And Bill and I met, and we became very close friends until he died in 1971. I don't know if I could have stayed sober or not without Bill's help, but he helped me and my wife and Lois, his wife, and all. They worked on the Al-Anon program, and we took trips together. And immensely I was helped by being able, today I think any of us give anything to have been that close to the co-founder of AA, but he's gone. But I was very lucky at being able to associate with Bill. Anyhow, while Bill was there, we met, that by that time we were a lot of groups springing up all over the Southwest. And they started calling them AA clubs. And such things like, and AA, the name of AA meant to a lot of different things that AA doesn't do. And they started calling Bill in New York day and night, that we got a problem down here. The AA club, Mary ran off of the money. And old John ran around, he's doing some things we ought not to do, and all kind. They kept Bill awake night and day. And he'd get on the train or a plane and come to Texas and try to put the fire out. And did. He helped us to form our groups and to make it known that we were in the business of the treatment of alcoholism. Not something else, not marriage counseling and all that other crap that you hear something about, but to stay sober and help somebody else stay sober. So, Bill's visit down there in 1920 and 1948, they had about 25 people in Lubbock, Texas to hold a little convention. And Bill and Lois came to Amarillo. They'd been to see his mother out in Arizona, and they came by way of Amarillo, and I met them up there and to go on down to Lubbock for him to talk. And when we got on the plane to go to Lubbock, Bill reached in his pocket and pulled out some handwritten notes and handed them to me. He said, "I want you to read these and see what you think about them. And then let me know." I read them over carefully, and I said, "Well, Bill, this is all right for you damn Yankees, but we don't need it down here. We love each other. Oh, God, how we love each other. We'll never have any trouble. We'll always be just like we are, just that we love each other to death. And what it was the 12 traditions Bill had written out. Aren't you glad I didn't start this thing? Woo! Lord! Well, that was in 48. And in the meantime, and by Bill's visit there on that trip, and I was convinced by Bill and by our records out there of how we were breaking all the things, traditions, if there were any, of doing things wrong. And so when they had the international conference in Cleveland, Ohio in 1950, well, by then I knew that we needed a tradition. I knew that we were gonna do things that we shouldn't do. How did we know? And how did Bill know? Because look at these things that happened. In 1842, the Washingtonian movement came along. And at one time, they had 300,000 drunk sober in the Washingtonian movement. What happened? They went into politics. They went into religion. They went into marriage counseling. They went into all these other things that there was not their primary purpose. And they went out of business. Along came the Oxford group, and with a solution to help the alcoholic. And they had four absolutes. Absolute honesty, absolute truthfulness, absolute add this and that. I asked Bill Wilson one time, why don't we have some absolutes in the AA program? He said, an alcoholic can't absolutely do anything. I think he's right about it. So, how these things happen is by the grace of God, and truly by the grace of God, that all these events happen. And we took the history. I've got a book that thick that a friend of mine wrote, and it took him many, many years. And there are 500 different ways that tried to help the alcoholic not drink. And what happened to every one of them was the same thing. They got away from their primary purpose. They got out of the business, what they were supposed to do, they got into other things. They got into politics, religion, and all those things. And then the Oxford group, they had some good things, and they gave, we got a lot of things from them in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but we damn sure didn't get the four absolutes. No, we didn't get that. Well, anyhow, show you how these things work. The traditions were written, and they what they did was they researched all of those organizations that ever tried to help the alcoholics. And they found out the reason why they went out of business, exactly. And so Bill said, we don't need to do that. Let's stay in business, show we have a tradition. The very thing that saved our lives and saved Alcoholics Anonymous are the 12 traditions. Even though I told Bill we didn't need them. I admit that I was wrong about that. But they had me on the floor down there in Cleveland at the first international to get votes, because we were going to vote on the 12 traditions that afternoon at 2:45. Well, Dr. Bob talked and Bill talked and the necessity of our traditions. And then the vote came up, and there was not a dissenting vote, not a one. Most of them didn't know what the hell they were voting for, but there was no dissenting vote, and we have the 12 traditions that saved us and saved Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, down the line, the way these things happened, in 19, down the line in about 1948, I went to the Yale School. I kept asking Bill Wilson all these questions about his religious experience, or whatever you want to call it, and how this happened, and what all these silly questions. And Bill finally told me one day, he said, "Why in the hell don't you go to the Yale School on alcohol studies and you'll learn all these things and then you'll know?" And I said, "Well, how do I go?" He said, "I'll send you." And he wanted to get rid of me. And I went up to the Yale School and studied, and I came home with the most knowledge you ever heard tell of. None of it worth a damn. But I knew all about the answers to all these questions I'd been asking Bill. So after we had we'll talk about it today here with some of the gals, how these things happened. And I was telling them about Dr. Jelinek, who was head of the Yale School on alcohol study. He came up from South America. He was a banana scientist down in South America. And they hired him up Yale University to head the Yale School on alcohol study. And I asked him one time, I said, "Bunky, how in the hell do you go from bananas to alcoholics? How'd you do that?" He said, "They're just alike. They get away from the bunch, they get peeled." So he's a great old guy, and he loved alcoholics, and he made it possible for us to study why we're alcoholics, as if it made any difference, but it really didn't. But it's important that we know that alcoholism is a disease, and the alcoholic's a sick person, and the alcoholic can be helped, and they're worth helping, and that it's a community problem and a community responsibility that we do something about it. So these things happen, and these events that happen through the year, what we need to think about is how important it is for us to stay with our primary purpose. And so here are the way the threads of spirituality are woven through all the fabric of AA. And look at these things. Old Bill Wilson's in town's hospital for the 40th time drunk. And his old school buddy, old Thatcher, old Abby Thatcher, came in to see him. And Abby is in the Oxford group. So Bill queried him, said, You're sober, Abby. What's happened?" And he said, so-and-so. He said, "Well, what's this religion you got?" He said, "Well, it's not religion. It's spirituality." "Well, what's the bottom line? What do you do?" And Abby said, "We trust God, clean house, and help others." And of all of our literature and all the things that have been written about AA and our literature and knowledge, the bottom line still is trust God, clean house, and help others. And that was before AA. So anyhow, Bill was an agnostic. He didn't believe in God, but he got on his knees that night and he said, "If there is a God, show himself to me." And as you know in Bill's story, the soft wind blew over him. He got on his knees and he never took another drink. So you think the power greater than we are had something to do with it. That's the way those threads are woven through our fabric. That's what happened. So anyhow, 6 months later, Abby got drunk, went down on the Bowery in New York, stayed down there. After I went to the Yale School and all, Dr. Jelinek wanted to retire in 1950. And he said, "Searcy, what the greatest need we have in this country is a hospital where drunks can go sober up and get into Alcoholics Anonymous and stay sober." But we don't have any, no hospital would accept a drunk. No, none of them. Not a hospital, not a one. So we, Dr. Garrett helped me establish four different hospitals. Alcoholic hospitals. They were medical, good medical hospitals, good doctors and good nurses. So we established one in Lubbock, we established one in Dallas, one in Houston and Carlsbad, New Mexico. In there, it was the best medical attention. They were detoxed and they were in pretty good shape. And all the time they're there, they're associated with members of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we take them to meetings and help them to be sure they stayed sober to begin with. And it worked. So, old Bill Wilson came to Dallas in 1953, early 53. And he went down to our hospital there and he visited with everyone. There were 15 patients and he visited with all of them. And we went to have lunch and I said, Bill, a lot of things have happened since 1935 when you and Dr. Bob got together, and this is 53. What would you rather see happen now that's never happened in AA? And without hesitation, he said, I'd rather see Abby have a chance to get sober. So Bill, you see, Abby was Bill's partner. But Abby stayed down there, he could have stayed sober. He wouldn't have lived on the bar from 35 until 53. And he was always Bill's sponsor. Why? Because he told him, trust God, clean house, and help others. And Bill never took another drink. Abby did. So that's true today. There's a lot of people in AA that helped me, and they can't stay sober, but they helped me. And that's true with all of us. That somebody helps us understand the need for sobriety and how we can stay sober. But we have to thank those who don't make it, those who have trouble. And another thing, while I'm talking about you young people, you are responsible, and I am grateful to, people ask me, what's the difference in AA than when you came? Not a damn bit of difference. Not a bit. We are different, yes. We got different problems, yes. But Alcoholics Anonymous is the same 12 steps, the same way to work it, and the same things to do as it ever was. Same thing. But the young people are coming, you younger people are coming on, and you must accept responsibility. And because you got to carry this flag, you got to carry this message to those who still suffer. And so, anyhow, Abby, after about 6 weeks, and we brought him down to Texas, we were talking about some of us having dinner tonight, how he came down there, and after about 6 weeks of coaching to try to get him, Bill wanted him to get sober real bad. And finally got him down there, but after about 6 weeks, he was not any better. And I called Bill and told him we were going to ship him back to New York. And he asked me to stay with him a little bit longer and see if we couldn't help him. So I turned him over to a nurse, a registered nurse, and she said, I believe I see a little change in Abby. Anyhow, make a long story short, I told her, I said, I couldn't see a damn bit of difference, and he just like it was, and he came in for them. she was a member of AA, and she worked, and about a week later, she came and said, I see some change in Abby. And you know, there's a poem that says, the change that we make by the touch of the Master's hand. Something happened. Somebody made it possible for you to change. And that's what happened to Abby. So, in a week or two, he came, wanted to know where I was going. I said, I'm going to Lubbock to speak at a convention. And he said, can I go with you? He went with me. And he got up that night and introduced himself and said, I'm Abby Thatcher, an alcoholic. And he said, I'm damn glad to be in AA and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's the way these things happen. You know, we've given up on Abby. And that's true with all of us. You know, we give up on somebody. But somebody out there can help that person. It may not be me, but somebody can do the job of that person. And that's not ever give up. You know, the most important thing we do in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's true, is right here tonight or anywhere we go, ever meet. Nobody, no alcoholic should ever leave an AA meeting unless if they have a problem, they have somebody to talk to, and we offer to offer our assistance to them. Let me help you. Let me be your sponsor. Let me tell you about AA. Let me tell you my story. Let me do something with you, for you. And then let's not let anybody leave a meeting without help if they need help. And it's the most important thing we do is to make sure that nobody leaves a meeting and people come in and they say, right, I don't want any part of that meeting. They go out and you never see me. And they get killed or something bad happens. So there's nobody hopeless and helpless in Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody. So let's not give up on anybody. And stay with them until they find a way to not drink anymore. So, I liken this. There's a poem during World War II that I think of every day almost now because it's so much like where we are with the young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that poem was, some guy wrote it that was in Holland, where 200,000 of our soldiers were killed during World War II, and they buried them there. And the guy wrote a poem about what happened and how they did their job and how they held the torch and did all these things to make it go. But then they got killed. Something happened. So that's true with us here. We've been here a while, we're going out, and you people are going to say, but this poem goes something like this. In Flanders Field, the poppies grow between the crosses row on row that mark our places, and in the skies, the lark still bravely singing flies. Scarce heard amidst the guns below, we're the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, but now we lie in Flanders Field. Pick up the quarrel with a foe to you. With failing hands we throw the torch. Be it yours to hold high. If you break faith with us who die, you shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders Field. That's exactly like we are, the young people. Take up the quarrel with us. Do these things. Experience helping others. Never give up on anybody. Because somebody died for us, and somebody went through all these things for us, and we're responsible to stay sober to help somebody else stay sober, and in turn we're given sobriety. So my main thoughts and are that we stay with the program, we stay with our primary purpose. If we ever get away from our primary purpose, then we'll have trouble. Always. So early on, those early days that I was telling you about, though, we did have some steps that didn't work. And I will read those steps to you. Number one, we had admitted we were powerless over nothing, that we could manage our lives perfectly and those of anyone else who would allow us to. We came to believe there was no power greater than ourselves, and the rest of the world was insane. We made a decision to have our loved ones, friends, and turn their will and lives over to our care, even though they couldn't understand us at all. We made a searching and fearless moral and immoral inventory of everybody we knew. We admitted to the whole world at large the exact nature of everybody else's wrong. We were entirely ready to make others straighten up and do right. We demanded others to either shape up or ship out. we made a list of all persons who had harmed us and became willing to get even with all of them. We got direct revenge on such people wherever possible, except when to do so would cost our lives and at least a jail sentence. We continued to take the inventory of others, and when they were wrong, we promptly and repeatedly told them about it. We sought through bitching and nagging to improve our relations with others, yet they couldn't understand us at all, asking only that they knuckle down and do things our way. Having had a complete physical, emotional, and spiritual breakdown as a result of this step, we tried to blame it on others and get pity and sympathy in all our affairs. That won't work. But yeah, we had some early promises too. And here are the 12 early promises. Look at these. You'll know your full name and address. You'll be able to shave yourself. You'll be able to dress and undress yourself at the appropriate time and places. You will at all times know the city, state, and country you're in. You'll routinely be able to find matching socks. That'll help me. You'll be able to smoke if you wish without burning holes in the clothes or the furniture. You'll lose the fear of food. You'll spend less time in the bathroom. You'll be able to walk a straight line and pass the balloon test. You'll lose the fear of police cars in your rearview mirror. You'll be able to answer the door without looking through the keyhole first. You'll realize what a mess you've been and thank God for AA and Al-Anon. But the real 12 rewards of Alcoholics Anonymous are these 12. Faith instead of despair. Courage instead of fear. Hope instead of desperation. Peace of mind instead of confusion. Real friendships instead of loneliness. Self-respect instead of self-contempt. Self-confidence instead of helplessness. A clean conscience instead of a sense of guilt. The respect of others instead of their pity and sympathy. A clean pattern of living instead of a purposeless existence. The love and understanding of our families instead of their doubts and fears. The freedom of a happy life instead of the bondage of an alcoholic obsession. Now those are the real rewards. So many things make me know that by the grace of God, this all happened. And all the mistakes we made individually and as a group and as AA as a whole are the mistakes that we made, not God. God is never wrong. He's always there. And he knows all of these things, bad, good, and indifferent that happen. He knows all of it, and he's aware of it. But he lets us choose the way we want to go. If you're not as close to God as you once were, make no mistake about who moved. And if you never were close to him, make no mistake about who should move. I'm not a religious nut or anything like that, but I am aware and more aware every day that without the aid of a power greater than ourselves that can restore us to sanity, we would not be sober today. We would never have sobriety. It's all by the grace of God. Whatever success we have in sobriety, whatever success we have with working with others, we have to give the credit back from where it came from. That's a power greater than we are. Absolutely. So, I'm sure you've heard a lot of these slogans. Life is a cinch by the inch, by the yard it's hard. Let go and let God. Spirituality is a reflection of godliness in the channels of human living. It's the things we aspire to be. It's not what we are. It's what we aspire to be, what we would like to be. Every one of us want to be a better person. Everyone. No matter what our situation is, we'd like to be better. We'd like to do better. We'd like to help others better. And so, and I ask these things when I turn my will and life over to the care of God every morning, and then I get on the freeway and take it back. And and I think about these things that I learned time, and a slogan that a guy gave me. He said, before you act on some of these things, you ask yourself, is it kind, is it true, and is it necessary? And sometimes that road rage will subside if you remember those things. It helped me. So time is the greatest factor in all change. We think, well, things are not happening like they should. I've been over here, but nothing's happening. Well, time is the greatest factor. It takes time, and we change with time. And it takes time, always. You only left what you have left, what you give away. And these things, know thyself, control thyself, and give of thyself, are important things in our program. So, as I told you, I went to finish high school in Stanford, Texas, out in West Texas. And they sure as hell didn't miss me at the high school there, I'll tell you that. But there was a guy I finished high school with named Stuart Hamblin. And Stuart, I never thought much of him because he's a Methodist, you know. And me being a Baptist, you know, you understand that? Some of you Baptists understand that. But he wrote a lot of religious and spiritual songs. And he wrote them for movies, religious, spiritual movies. And almost every spiritual, religious movie that was produced, Stuart wrote the words and the music to it. And 2.5 years before he died, he called me and wanted to know if I'd be a sponsor. I said, yes, I will. I didn't know you had a problem. He said, yes, I do. But he said, I want to get sober, and he stayed sober 2.5 years before he died. While we were chatting, I told him, I said, you wrote one of your songs you wrote, I think you wrote it for Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, I wanted to know which song that was. You know, some of his old songs were This Old House and a lot of songs like that. He wrote a song that it is no secret what God can do. And don't leave, I'm not going to sing it. But, but it goes, I have done it, yeah. Old Bob Smith and I did every once in a while sing. But it goes like, the chimes of time ring out the news, another day is through. Someone slipped and fell. Was that someone you? You may have longed for added strength, your courage to renew. Do not be disheartened, because I've got news for you. It is no secret what God can do. There is no night, for in his light you'll never walk alone. You'll always feel at home, wherever you may roam. There is no power can conquer you while God is on your side. Just take him at his promise. Don't run away and hide. It is no secret what God can do. What he's done for others, he'll do for you. With arms wide open, he'll pardon you. It is no secret what God can do. So, I want to thank all of you again for so much courtesy and so much help and all the things you've done for me. Even these little gals right here this afternoon, I was freezing to death, and she went out and came back with all these jackets and said, I don't want you to freeze. You know, things, nice things like that have happened since I've been here. Got me, it didn't get one, she got two, so if one didn't fit, the other one did. I want to thank Dave Denny for taping this thing. He drove all the way from Florida up here to do so. But he didn't drive it all just to tape. He came up here to see me. So I was going to challenge each and every one of you. And how important each one of you are. And how we must have each one of you. And that you're somebody's waiting for you to tell them how to say so. So, I challenge you that we abandon ourselves to God as you understand God. Clear away the wreckage of the past. Admit our faults to each other. And as we trudge down this road of happy destiny, I have no doubt in my mind that all of us, somewhere, some way, somehow, sometime, we'll meet again. And until then, God bless all of you and thank you. I appreciate and love every one of you. Thank you.